Välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, en podcast från Boehringer Ingelheim Animal Health. I den här podden samtalar vi med specialister från olika områden inom hästmedicinen. Med det gemensamt att de delar vår och din passion för hästarna. Hej, välkommen till Hästveterinärerna, podden för dig som är veterinär eller djursjukskötare och jobbar med hästar. Jag heter Maria Willemsson. I de kommande avsnitten så talar jag och min kollega Louise med Andy Durham om PPID hos häst. Andy har en lång meritlista inom hästmedicin. Och förutom att han har en diplomat i internmedicin och en välrenommerad forskare inom endokrinologi så är han också ansvarig för laboratoriet på Lippock Equine Hospital. Vi träffade Andy när han besökte Boehringer Ingelheim i Köpenhamn för att spela in två webbinarier om PPID. Ett om diagnostik och ett om behandling och monitorering. Dessa webbinarier hittar du på vetportal.se och de kan jag verkligen rekommendera. I det här första poddavsnittet med Andy så pratar vi om provtagning och pretest probability och vad som är viktigt att ta hänsyn till när man provtar för PPID. Welcome, Andy, to the podcast.
Oh, thank you very much. Pleasure to be here and participate.
Why don't you tell us a little bit about your clinical work and what you've done in the past and, yeah, a little bit about yourself.
Okay. When I graduated, I started off working in a very mixed practice. Probably had a slight equine bias, but very mixed, all species, which was great. I soon got a bit disillusioned with small animal practice and started then working in another one with farm animals and equine, and then eventually came to Lippock in 1994 just to do equine only, which is clearly where my heart lay. I didn't necessarily know that when I graduated, but certainly over the first few years in practice, became very equine focused.
Hmm. Do you have horses?
No, not specifically. I don't have time for horses, really. But I'm sure I will, actually, as time goes by, and perhaps I'd sort of do less work in time.
Yeah.
Undoubtedly, I'll keep some then. But no, I don't have time now to keep any.
Yeah. On the to-do list.
Yeah.
And you've also done quite an amount of research and published a lot of research in especially the endocrine field. Can you tell us a little bit about your research interests and where does it come from, the endocrinology interest?
I think the endocrinology interest, you know, slightly strangely started in my first equine job, actually, when I was just presented with a horse who was in his 20s, had a curly coat, had polydipsia, had laminitis, had a pot belly, and I had no idea what was wrong with that horse. I thought this was a really bizarre situation. Obviously, now it'd be patently obvious to anybody this was a PPID case, but PPID had never been mentioned during my veterinary degree in the 1980s, and I found it such a bizarre presentation. But obviously there was information out there about PPID. It just hadn't been mentioned during my veterinary course. So that just stimulated my interest. And upon, you know, a little bit of research in textbooks and papers or whatever, discovered this condition called PPID that was obviously out there. And I don't know what it was really. It just really interested me. I can still remember now, actually. Jill Beach, who was lecturing at New Bolton at the time, had written a textbook chapter in current equine and current therapy in equine medicine, and Edward Robinson's book. And I could tell you, page 183, I still remember that on that in that textbook about pituitary disease and Cushing's disease and pituitary pars intermedia dysfunction just really stimulated my interest. And so after dealing with that horse and then obviously recognizing that there were more out there, thinking, you know, this is just weird. It's something that wasn't mentioned at university, yet there are so many cases. And then subsequently, I suppose almost the same thing happened again, didn't it? In, you know, round about 1999, 2000, all of a sudden, we started talking about this condition called equine metabolic syndrome. We weren't talking about it at all before. Mm-hmm. Like it didn't exist then. All of a sudden it did. And we're seeing cases not every month. We're seeing cases every day. Where did it come from? You know, so I thought both of those conditions were kind of bizarre, really, in that almost one minute we didn't even recognize they existed, and the next minute we're seeing them every day. Mm. And so you know, it's great when people have a real interest in rare conditions, because somebody needs to, I suppose. But I suppose to have a great interest in really common conditions is probably more useful, or it certainly is in my view, at least anyway. So seeing these conditions that everybody in equine practice sees every day, yet we didn't really know much about, you know, absolutely requires, you know, more information and more investigation. And that's the easiest thing in the world, isn't it? I think when you're trying to research a rare condition, you've got a problem. When you're trying to research a condition that's really common, well, all the data's there, and you just got to gather it and look at it and interpret it and decide what are the questions we need answering, and everything's easy then because there's loads and loads of data to look through. So that suits me fine, really. I think we can find lots of information and answer lots of questions then.
And you certainly have been answering a lot of questions in the endocrine field during your work, although there are still lots of questions remaining to be answered. So we've been doing a webinar on diagnostics of PPID in particular. And for your listeners who haven't watched it yet, I strongly recommend you to do so, because it's very interesting and informative. And I think, Louise, you have some follow-up questions from the webinar that you have been watching together with me.
Yes, I have. So, Andy, just to recap some of the most important take-home messages from your webinar, when we look at the prevalency of these PPID horses, what would you say the prevalence is in a general? What does the research show us so far with the prevalencies?
Yeah, well, I you know, obviously PPID is one of those conditions that, you know, not like some kind of infection or whatever that spread across different populations or whatever. It's, you know, it's very much tuned into the older population. So if we ignore that and sort of look across different populations, the prevalence will be, you know, very low, the kind of 2-3% at most, really, in terms of a general equine population. Undoubtedly, as they get older, it increases. So, you know, 15 is commonly used slightly arbitrarily as a little bit of a cutoff, which probably isn't entirely fair, but certainly several studies have looked at populations older than 15 and, you know, more or less come up with the same kind of prevalence figures, around about 20-25% of horses over 15, that kind of prevalence, which, you know, when you think about many diseases, that's still pretty prevalent, actually, isn't it? You know, to get a quarter of horses over 15 affected by a disease is quite something, really.
So when the vets come out and look at these horses, and the question comes up, should I test this horse for PPID? There's a fairly new concept that we've heard of now that's called the pretest probability. So how are we going to handle that? What is that exactly? What does that tell the vet? What should they use that pretest probability for?
Yeah, well, pretest probability is a really, really important thing. And it's a very simple concept. You know, all pretest probability is when you're standing there looking at a horse or chatting with the owner, you know, what's your guess at the likelihood this has got this condition? You know, is it a real unlikely, you know, you're talking about a four-year-old thoroughbred or whatever that's clinically healthy, well, the chances of it having PPID is close to zero, I suppose. And if you're talking about a 35-year-old that's never shedding its coat and it's getting some of the other clinical signs, then it's almost definitely, you know. So it's what's your best guess when you're standing there looking at the horse? So it's a very simple concept in that respect. And I think many of us probably have some understanding or some memory from our days at vet school when some of the statistical teachers might have been talking about pretest probability. But I think what many of us may have forgotten is how really important it is in a practical everyday sense to us in practice, because it has a massive effect on the reliability of your test results. And it's very easy to prove that with, you know, playing around with a few little numbers, which we did in the webinar, that, you know, essentially what it means is two horses that might have exactly the same test result, in one of those, you know, exactly the same positive test result, that is, in one of those, you could probably absolutely rely on that test result being accurate and it's diagnosed PPID for you. And in the other one, even though it's a positive test result, it's probably wrong. And that is really important. And so you have to bear in mind, but however boring it might seem, you know, pretest probability is a reality to us in practice when we're interpreting these results. And essentially it means if you don't have a reasonably strong clinical suspicion, if it's a real guess and a gamble, you shouldn't be doing it. You've got to have a reasonable probability, and the way it just happens to work in terms of where the sensitivities and specificities are of using ACTH for diagnosing PPID, it just happens to be that unless you think it's more likely than not this horse does have PPID, if you don't think it's more likely than not, you shouldn't really be testing, because using a pretest probability of 50%, in other words, if there's about a 50-50 chance that it has it, then that will equate to about a 90% chance your positive test result is correct. And I think that's the kind of level we should be looking at. So if it's less than a 50-50 chance in your judgment, you probably shouldn't really be testing it, because even if it tests positive, it may well be wrong.
Yeah. So it links into the risk of getting false positives and false negatives.
Yeah, it does, absolutely, because it kind of works, you know, in both ways, really, that if we're talking about positive results, then, yeah, the higher your suspicion is, then the more reliable a positive result will be. But also the less reliable a negative result will be.
Yes.
But you know, generally speaking, it's the positive results obviously that we're acting upon. And you cannot really trust a positive result if you didn't really have good grounds to suspect the horse had that condition in the first place.
So essentially, when we diagnose the PPID horses, we look at the clinical signs, the age, and then we link it to the blood test. And the blood test that we have, the thing that we do measure is ACTH. But you also mentioned in your webinar that there are some other things that could influence on the disease itself, and it might not just be ACTH that's increased from the pituitary gland. So what else is there that we can't measure yet, but hopefully in the future?
Yeah, that's right. I mean, you know, I think it's one area that we still have a surprisingly poor understanding of. You know, obviously we're talking about an endocrine disease, and any endocrine disease involves obviously secretion of something. And you know, we know insulin comes from the pancreas or whatever, and there can be diseases associated with that. But it's obviously much more complex in terms of PPID. There's a whole kind of peptide soup, really, that comes out of the pituitary gland. There are a number of different peptides. ACTH is just one of them, and it's probably not even the most prevalent one. We have selected that as a target for testing, not really for any strong, robust reason, to be honest. It's certainly not the, you know, the main product of the pars intermedia, but it's relatively easy to test. And so far, at least anyway, all of the other potential target peptides, notably things like alpha-MSH, that's alpha-melanocyte stimulating hormone, or beta-endorphin, they would be the two main ones, which are secreted in greater concentrations than ACTH. But so far, at least anyway, attempts to use those diagnostically have not really shown them to be any better. And I think the other thing quite crucially is the ease of testing. You know, obviously PPID, as we've said, is a relatively prevalent condition, and therefore vets in practice, you know, will be submitting a fair number of samples to laboratories. And so it's got to be a test that can deal with reasonable volumes. And, you know, using things like radioimmunoassay or whatever, you know, can be quite sort of cumbersome and slow, or even some of the enzyme immunoassays. But you know, ACTH is very easy to automate on a relatively large scale, and seeing as nothing else has yet outdone it, and I, you know, sort of emphasize yet, because I think it's perfectly possible we may well come up with better biomarkers. There may be other peptides that come out of the pars intermedia that we just don't even recognize yet. You know, it was interesting, some studies back in the early 1980s, which, you know, were great studies, but obviously in today's terms, probably relatively crude analytical processes. But really intriguingly, a couple of peptides were identified in PPID cases that they couldn't define what they were, and no one has defined what they were. Now, you know, further work on that might turn out that they weren't anything interesting anyway. But or it might be that there are other peptides that are produced in PPID that we just haven't picked up yet, and they could be really useful diagnostically.
Are there other risk factors? So we have the clinical signs we have. We know age is important.
Yeah.
There's something about breed as well. Can you elaborate a little bit on that?
Yeah, well, I mean, breed has cropped up in a lot of studies over the years as, you know, I suppose particularly pony breeds. You know, there's quite a few studies suggesting ponies may be more likely to get PPID than a lot of horse breeds. But yeah, the evidence is certainly not very strong on that. And different people have found different things. But I wouldn't say there's any compelling evidence that ponies are more predisposed to PPID than horses. You know, some people will go further than that and say it's more the EMS types, you know, the kind of fat, good doing, easy keeper types that are more likely to get PPID. And yeah, I wouldn't necessarily disagree with that, but at the same time, I don't think the evidence is very strong to support that.
Yeah. Okay.
Test probability again. Do you think it's as so to say easy to say that you can have like a score sheet or a list of, you know, questions to ask or anything that you can just tick boxes that okay, this it scores this one. So probability is this much, or is it more sort of complicated than that? Or
well, so yeah, I mean, both of them, really, I suppose. I mean, you know, I know certain publications, teachers, whatever, love these kind of algorithmic type
yeah.
things where you tick this box and give it that score. And you can see the attraction of that because it makes it all kind of neat and tidy. But I suppose I've always felt as a veterinarian, that's essentially what your brain's processing when you're kind of looking at it, really,
yeah.
isn't it? But so yeah, both of those would stand up. You know, I think it's fair enough to have a chat with the owner, examine the horse and think, well, yeah, you know, it looks like a PPID case to me, or no, I don't think that's got PPID. I think that's kind of acceptable, you know, as a starting point in applying pretest probability. But I think, yeah, to do it more objectively, as you suggest, I think that would be an interesting idea where you are, you know, literally grading its risk on the basis of, well, how old is this horse?
Yeah.
You know, is it 4 or 5, in which case you got pretty much zero chance, you know, or is it 25, 30 years old, in which case there's a much higher chance? Obviously, that's a sliding scale over different ages. You know, PPID cases have been reported as young as 6 or 7 years old. Now, they're really rare, but they do happen. So it's not completely impossible. But obviously, by the time they're getting to 10, 15, 20, it's much more likely. So certainly putting age into it, absolutely. The clinical signs, you know, the more clinical signs associated with PPID there are, the more, the higher, if you like, the pretest probability is. But interestingly, it only really is abnormal hair growth that really stands up well statistically to be associated with PPID. And is undoubtedly, you know, the commonest sign of PPID in pretty much all publications. There are other clinical signs, obviously, like, you know, excessive sweating or even the opposite, actually, in some countries, anhidrosis. There's the kind of pot-bellied picture. There's PUPD, abnormal fat deposition. There's, you know, losing some back muscle and all that. You know, there's lots of things, and laminitis, obviously, there's lots of things we might associate with PPID, which, again, in a scoring system would score, but probably not as strongly as abnormal hair growth. But yeah, I absolutely could imagine the circumstance where you can develop some kind of algorithm, if you like, that all adds up to, okay, we haven't done a lab test yet, but we've examined the horse and we've talked to the owner. And on the basis of these bits of information, you know, there's a 65% chance that this is probably PPID, and then you can use the lab result validly then to add confirmation of your suspicion. But
yeah. But
I suppose that's the important point, really. You know, you're not using the lab test on some kind of fishing expedition, you know, to see if it might or might not have PPID. You're using the lab test to support your clinical suspicion. So your clinical suspicion has to have passed that 50% threshold before you're even doing it. And when it's passed that 50% threshold, in other words, in your judgment, there's at least a 50-50 chance this horse does have PPID, then you can use the lab test to support your suspicion. If you're using a lab test to diagnose PPID when there's a less than 50-50 chance in your view that's what the horse has got, then you will get false positive results then.
Yeah. Yeah, I mean, and just the, how do you say, clinical experience and so forth. Of course, you can't always have a questionnaire or a score sheet to that would replace your clinical judgment. But maybe if, because we do see some vets that work in a lot in mixed practice and maybe not particularly into equines, but they also see these patients every once in a while. And of course, not to forget the new veterinarians who just graduated. For them, it maybe could be a good guide or...
Oh, yeah. No, absolutely. I think, you know, I'd be all for that, really. I think if it obviously would be a... If you're going to have some kind of algorithmic approach, obviously it's got to be valid and accurate. So that's the kind of thing that if you, you know, if you're going to apply weightings to different things, you know, age would be important. Abnormal hair growth would be important. Yeah. Things like polydipsia, less important, but nevertheless, you know, relevant. You know, you'd have to weight these appropriately. But I think that's the kind of work that, you know, could be done, absolutely. And I think that probably would be very valuable to people.
Yeah. And speaking of symptoms, so Maria talked about the younger vets and people that might not have seen these cases that much. How do they recognize them by their long hair growth? But is that really a problem for the PPID horses? The key thing is that I guess there are other of these symptoms that are clearly something that could affect the quality of life in these horses.
Yeah, well, that's a really important consideration, isn't it? Particularly when you're thinking about potentially treating this horse for the rest of its life. You know, I suppose there probably are some circumstances where excessive hair growth is a bit of a nuisance, but, you know, there are a lot worse things horses have. Yeah. And, you know, if that's the only sign of PPID, yeah, you could easily argue, does it really matter or does that really merit treatment? But I think out of all of the things that, all of the signs you see associated with PPID, you know, yeah, as you're suggesting, I guess some are clearly important and some aren't. And I think, you know, the ones that stand out to me really would be laminitis. You know, my experience has been that if you euthanize a horse because of PPID, you're really euthanizing it because of laminitis that you can't control. Susceptibility to infections is something that crops up. I don't know. I personally, this is just a personal view, but I've always just been a little bit cynical about that. I think there is information there suggesting immunosuppression, but I do worry that it's a little bit made up in that, you know, when we started talking about PPID, I think there was a natural inclination to make an analogy with hyperadrenocorticism in other species. And we know that's hypercortisolemic, you know, say in dogs or humans or whatever, and therefore it's hypercortisolemic, so they'll be immunosuppressed. So everyone was really ready to accept that PPID involved immunosuppression. I mean, we now know that the cortisol is not particularly abnormal in PPID cases. And when you look back on, you know, I've asked people this question before, you know, so when you're talking about immunosuppression in PPID, what are you talking about? What are you seeing? And the things that tend to crop up are recurrent foot abscesses. Well, that's laminitis, as far as I'm concerned. Really, that's what's caused the recurrent foot abscesses, damage to the laminae, and sinus infections. Well, you're talking about horses in their teens and 20s and 20s. I mean, they're going to get sinus infections from dental issues. So you know, I mean, if we were seeing lots of PPID cases that keep getting bizarre pneumonias or something like that, then fine. But I remain to be convinced that immunosuppression and recurrent infections is a significant issue, but anyway, that's a personal view. But if it is, then that obviously could be potentially important and health threatening. And I suppose the other thing would be a catabolic kind of status. Now, again, you could throw the same argument at that one and say that's easy to accept if you're talking about hypercortisolemia and, you know, these pot-bellied dogs with hyperadrenocorticism or whatever, and it's not the same disease as horses. But nevertheless, I would have to accept that you do see horses with PPID that do seem to lose muscle off their backs and develop this kind of pot-bellied appearance for whatever reason. And, you know, weight loss can be an issue with PPID, either in the few cases that develop true diabetes and will lose weight, or even in those that don't. I don't think the weight loss tends to be profound in these, but nevertheless, you know, it's not in a horse's interest necessarily to be losing weight like that. So I think that is something probably deserving of treatment, and maybe along the same lines, although there isn't a lot of evidence behind it, there are some, there is quite a lot of good information out there suggesting that some horses with PPID that are kept in work can be more prone to tendon injury and that kind of thing. And you even see those that aren't in work, actually, that really seem to, you know, lose their suspensory apparatus almost, and the fetlocks come really low, almost like there is some catabolic effect on tendons and ligaments too. So I suppose all of those things are threatening then, the laminitis, possibly infections, and the catabolic status maybe of PPID cases, but arguably the hair coat changes or the PUPD or the sweating or whatever, I mean, does it really matter? You know, it's maybe it does to some people, but I don't think they're the worst clinical signs to have.
No, the laminitis seems to be the major one for that's contributing to loss of quality of life if they tend to get it recurrent. Yeah, and life at all in general. Yeah. Are there any studies looking at the function of immune system in PPID horses that you know of?
Not much. I suppose the one that does stand out is Diane McFarlane published on susceptibility to parasitism. Mm. And, you know, we do know that that the immune system is very important in controlling parasitism, hence the kind of age prevalence you'll see, you know, young horses and older horses. And Diane McFarlane's work certainly indicated that horses with PPID were more prone to parasitism. Yeah. So I suppose there is that. You know, there's other bits of work, perhaps not looking at clinical susceptibility, but looking at, you know, various aspects of the immune system, you know, sort of, you know, interleukins and all this kind of stuff, which will be consistent with an immunosuppressive status. But I think it's a fairly light amount of evidence compared to the, you know, the dogma, if you like, that PPID is associated with immunosuppression, which I'm not saying it isn't, but I'm just a little bit more skeptical maybe still.
Could be interesting to look at neutrophil function and all these things. Because we sometimes talk about delayed wound healing and all those
and
things.
Corneal ulcers and that.
Exactly.
That kind of thing.
So neutrophil function could be interesting too.
So to wrap this episode up and to summarize a little bit, could you give us three important take-home messages that you would want to distribute to every Nordic vet listening to this podcast that you think is the most important things when it comes to diagnostics of PPID?
Yeah, I suppose the diagnostic test choice is relatively easy. You know, I think certainly as things stand at the moment, it's difficult to see beyond basal ACTH, so that's kind of straightforward. But I think the application of that result, I think, is really important. I think there are lots of reasons around ACTH which mean that you may well be making incorrect diagnoses, and we go to this in a bit more detail in the webinars. But you know, we do need to have, like it or not, we do need to have a strong awareness of pretest probability. If you don't consider that, you will be making false positive and potentially false negative decisions. We're also offering some information. I mean, I think we're all well aware of the seasonality of ACTH now. I think most vets and laboratories are aware that it's not the same cutoff all year round. I think that's fine. But, you know, one thing that's probably more recent information is the breed effect as well. There are certain breeds that just will naturally have higher ACTH concentrations, and sometimes all year round. So donkeys and Arabian horses, for example, tend to have slightly higher values all year round. So, you know, don't be tempted to make a diagnosis in a donkey or an Arabian if they're just mildly to moderately increased, because that's probably normal for them. Mm. And other breeds, in the UK, the Shetland pony and Welsh types certainly stand out in terms of having pretty high values sometimes in normal horses. Mm. Probably July, August through to September, October, those months particularly, you've got to be really careful with. I did look at a little bit of data that we've got on some Nordic breeds, and unfortunately I don't have great numbers, but there is a suggestion there that Icelandic horses may well be the same as the Welsh and Shetland in terms of having higher values in the autumn. So don't overinterpret that in an Icelandic if it's a bit high. I think that's got to be subject to a bit more investigation, but there's a suspicion there, unlike the Fjord horse, which didn't seem to do that. Actually, the Fjord horse was just kind of more in with the rest of the breeds. So that's important to take breed into account. I suppose the third thing I would probably say is, don't forget about insulin. Insulin is a crucial part of a PPID assessment. ACTH may tell you whether it's got PPID or not, but the insulin tells you whether it's likely to get laminitis or not. And as we've just discussed, that might be the most important thing about PPID in terms of determining that horse's life. Yeah. So don't forget insulin. It's a really, really important part of it. And you will find a lot, probably more than half PPID cases actually don't have an issue with insulin, and at least not now. They might do next year or whatever, but at the time of testing them, their insulin's fine, and so there's no obvious increased risk of laminitis with those, so you can manage them relatively normally. But maybe a third or so of them will be insulin dysregulated, and so I kind of describe those to clients really as, you've got to think of your horse as being a fat pony now.
Yeah.
Even if it's not a fat pony, it is metabolically.
Yeah.
And that's really important to know. And you've got to manage it differently, just like it was a fat pony. And if you don't, you're going to get laminitis as if it was a fat pony.
Yeah.
So don't forget about insulin testing, because it's an absolutely crucial part of PPID assessment.
And we're going to come back to that in the next episode. So we're going to be talking more about insulin and insulin dysregulation and PPID. Thank you very much for joining, Andy.
A pleasure.
Tack för att du lyssnar på Hästveterinärerna. Om du gillar det du hör, glöm inte att trycka prenumerera i din podcast-app så att du inte missar några avsnitt. Berätta också gärna om vad du tycker genom att ge en recension. Vi tar gärna emot tips på kommande gäster och ämnen, och våra kontaktuppgifter finns i poddens beskrivning.